I'd like you to do something with me this morning. Can you just imagine paradise? Go ahead, picture it. Imagine paradise. If you need to close your eyes, close your eyes. Just don't go to sleep. Just picture paradise. What does it look like? What's going on? What are you doing there? Or maybe more importantly, what are you not doing there? Who's there? Or maybe more importantly, who's not there? Sometimes I start to do this picture paradise and I wonder, wait a minute, if I'm there, is it really going to be paradise? Because I'm not always happy with myself. But get a picture of paradise in your head, because this morning I want to talk about paradise. It's one of the last things Jesus talks about. One of the last things Jesus mentions when he's hanging on that cross is paradise. And so I want to look at that today, because for the last few weeks we've been looking at Jesus' last words, the things he said on the cross. And I encourage you to go home and open the Bible and read through the Gospels and see what Jesus did on that cross. You'll be amazed. Because of all the things he said there on the cross, everything he said about people or to people was just filled with compassion. So to the people who were nailing him to the cross, Jesus prayed for them and said, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Then he looks and he sees his mother there crying and weeping over him. No mother should have to watch this happen. And he looks at her and he says, tells her to look at his friend John, who's there with her, and says, look at him. He's your son now. And he looks at his friend John and says, she's your mother. He's filled with compassion. He's hanging on a cross in agony. And what does he do? He looks and cares with compassion for his mother. Even to one of the criminals hanging next to him, Jesus shows compassion. This guy is going through what is, without a doubt, the worst day of his life. And Jesus transforms it into the best day of his life by looking at him and saying, today you'll be with me in paradise. So I want to look at paradise today, because if we understand this moment, if we can wrap our minds around this moment and what Jesus is saying and what Jesus is doing, it'll change our lives. Some of you may be like that one, those two criminals on the cross in the worst moment of your life, in the darkest time. Some of you may be doing fine. Either way, what Jesus has to say to us about paradise will change your life forever. And so I want to look at that encounter together with you. It's in Luke chapter 23, so that's in the bulletin you received when you came in, or if you're following along in the app, it's there and you can take notes. Or you can follow along on the screen. But Luke chapter 23, we're going to start in verse 39. This is the encounter that Jesus has with the two criminals who are hanging on the crosses on either side of him. One of the criminals, verse 39 says, who hung there, started hurling insults at Jesus. He said, aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us. But the other criminal rebuked him. He says, don't you fear God, since you're under the same sentence? We are punished justly, for we're getting what our deeds deserve, but this man has done nothing wrong. And then he said, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus looked him in the eyes and said, truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise. So I know I asked you to just picture paradise in your head, but what is paradise really? If you look at the Bible, the word it uses, the Greek word for paradise, simply means garden. And the Bible talks about garden in a couple places. Some of you will all automatically remember the very beginning of the Bible in Genesis, where it talks about the Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve. God puts them in this garden, and it is paradise. Why is it paradise? Is it because of all the beautiful flowers and trees and the incredible, amazing fruits and all that? Is it because of the animals not fighting each other? What makes it paradise? In the end, if you go and read Genesis, what you'll see is what makes it paradise is that they're with Jesus. They're with God. They're in God's presence. That God walks with them in the garden. And they get to experience God. What makes it paradise is they're with God. Another place where the Bible talks about paradise is at the end. When it talks about when God recreates and renews creation. Heaven and earth are renewed and now joined together, not broken apart by our sin. And it talks about that place as a garden, as a place where we'll encounter God's amazing presence all the time. We'll live in God's presence. Paradise is being with God. It's not going to be paradise because it's got streets of gold. When the Bible talks about that, what it's simply saying is Imagine the most amazing thing you can imagine, like the best metal on earth, one of the most precious metals on earth. That's the stuff we walk on there. That's what it's trying to communicate. It's not that it's streets of gold that make it special. It's not that it's pearly gates that make it special. That's just pictures to help us understand this is an amazing place, far greater than anything you could even imagine. But what makes it so amazing, what makes it paradise, is that there'll be no more barrier between us and God. We'll be with God. Paradise is being with God. And so when Jesus says to that criminal hanging there next to him, "Today you'll be with me in paradise," the most important part of that sentence is not paradise, which we love to talk about and think about and even sing about. Oh, paradise, paradise, we'll get to escape and run away. No, the most important part of that sentence is when Jesus says, "Today you'll be with me." Because it's being with God that is paradise. And what happens here in this moment with these two criminals crucified on either side of Jesus paints a picture for us, a picture of the choice you and I have to make. Because the three of them hang there suspended above the earth for everyone to see, representing Jesus, the way into paradise, into God's presence, and representing the two different ways you and I can respond to Jesus, can react to Jesus. These are two bad men hanging here, right? They deserve to be crucified. They said it. They knew it. They deserve to be crucified. They know that they are not good guys. It's not that one guy's a good guy and the other guy's a bad guy. They're both bad guys. They're the same. Just like all of us, they're guilty. Just like you and I, they're guilty. And there's Jesus dying on the cross between them, dying on that cross for them, for their guilt, for my guilt, for your guilt. And the only difference between these two men, the difference that determines whether they experience and enter paradise, is how they respond to Jesus. Your future is determined by how you respond to Jesus. This morning, I want to ask you, which criminal are you going to be? I know that seems like a weird question, but which criminal are you going to be? Let's look at the bad criminal, the wrong criminal, the one who rejects Jesus first. The guy hanging there looks at Jesus, and this is what you do. If you do not want to experience God's presence, if you do not want paradise, then this is how you respond to Jesus, because he looks at Jesus and says, starts insulting him, making fun, and says, "Aren't you the Messiah? Well, come on, well, save yourself and save us too while you're at it." And I want to pull what he said apart so we can understand how not to respond to Jesus. And the first thing I'm going to pull out from this is this. Don't surf the crowd. Because we've heard other people say this very same thing. "Oh, you're the Messiah? Why don't you step off the cross then and show us?" He's not the first person to say this. The whole story of Jesus' crucifixion, first you hear the religious leader saying this. "Oh, you're the Messiah? Well, come on then, Jesus. Get down off the cross. Show us you're the Messiah." And then the Roman soldiers, "Oh, you're a king? All right, Jesus, get down off the cross. Show us how powerful you are." And then the crowds walking by, just shaking their heads at Jesus, saying, "Oh my goodness, you're the one who's supposed to save us? You're the Messiah? You can't even save yourself. You look at you, you're pathetic." They're all saying the same thing. So where does this guy get the idea? Where does this criminal hanging on the cross get the idea that Jesus is weak and powerless and not really the Messiah because he's not getting down off the cross? He gets it from the crowd around him. Even though it's the same crowd that just nailed him to a cross. Even though these are the same people who said, "You know what, you're human garbage. We're going to figure out a way to kill you in the most painful way possible. Here, we're going to hang you out on a cross until you die." Yet the draw and the power and the pull of the way everyone else was thinking is so powerful that even though they're the ones who killed him, he's compelled to join them and to view Jesus through the lens they view Jesus through. That's why I say, if you want to avoid Jesus, then go ahead and keep listening to what everyone else says and let everyone else decide what you should think about Jesus. I saw an article once that caught my eye because the title was so weird. It talked about a flock of sheep all fall to their death off a cliff in Matthewicide, which is just a stupid pun on not you as in you and me, but you, E-W-E. And the story goes this way. In Turkey, there was a group of shepherds who were eating their breakfast, and they had a flock of about 1,500 sheep. It's what this whole community lived on. These sheep were incredibly valuable to them because in a place that only earns, maybe each person earns $2,700 a year, These sheep represented over $100,000 worth of assets. And they're sitting there eating their breakfast, and they watch one of the sheep walk up to a cliff and then step off. And they're like, oh my goodness, what a dumb sheep. But then to their horror, almost 1,500 other sheep all just follow and start jumping off the cliff after him. They lost almost 500 sheep that day. And you're like, well, wait a minute. How'd they lose just 500 if 1,500 jumped off? It's because after the first 500 got there, sheep are kind of soft, right? It's what you make your clothes out of. And so they managed to survive. But I listen to something like that, and I think that makes me stop and think, okay, where do I get my ideas about Jesus? Is it just, oh, this is what I've heard other people say, and this is, oh, you know, people say, oh, there's no really way, any way to know, and it could be this, it could be that, and I'm just listening to what everyone else says, or have I truly investigated and said, okay, did Jesus really rise from the dead? Is Jesus really God? What have I done to go and pursue him, or are my ideas just coming from everyone else? Am I following a crowd? Because even when the world is chewing you up and spitting you out, it can still get in your head and shape the way you think. And that's one reason this guy misses out on Jesus, because he just goes with the crowd, even though it's the same crowd that's killing him. The second reason is something I call the try God mentality. You know, let me try God to see if he makes my life better. And if he does, then cool, I'll keep, you know, going to church, I'll keep, you know, praying or whatever I'm supposed to do. I mean, just like, you know, I'm going to try the gym, I'm going to try yoga, I'm going to try Buddhism, I'm going to try meditation, I'm going to try all these things, and whatever works, you know, we'll see what happens. That pragmatist way. That criminal hanging there on the cross, he's mocking Jesus, but at the same time, he's like, well, yeah, Jesus, go ahead and save yourself. And seriously, if you can, save us too. Because if it's going to work, then yeah, he'll embrace Jesus if it's going to work. But the only way he's even going to consider that is if Jesus can get him down off the cross right now. And that's the way a lot of us do it too. We live our lives completely disregarding who Jesus is. And then suddenly we get to a bad spot. We get to the end of our rope. And what do? All right, Jesus, you know, I'm going to try you. Maybe you can help me. And then we pray and we show up. And then, oh, Jesus, you know, please, please, please. This is what I would call garden tool Jesus. Garden tool Jesus. I've got some mud, I've got some dirt I got to deal with, so I go and I get God out of the shed, and I hope he's going to help me get this dirty work done. And then when I'm done, I go put him back in the shed, and, you know, maybe you got a few tools in there, right, that you just try this and that, depending on what's going on in your life, and Jesus is just one of those tools. Just try whatever works. And it reminds me of the story of how my grandparents met and got married. This beautiful love story of my father's father went up to my grandmother one day and told her, look, Ada, I'm going to go upstate. We were in New York at the time. I'm going to go upstate, and I'm going to ask Mary to marry me. If she says no, I'm going to come back, and I'm going to marry you. That's not the way it worked. That's not the way it's supposed to work, right? That's not how relationships work. And that definitely won't work with God. God is not a tool, right? The way into God's presence is not to treat him like some tool. Okay, God, you know, I'll go to church and I'll, you know, do some stuff and I'll pray just enough to get you started up so I get some power in my life to help me with some things. And then Jesus, you know, when I need that tool to help me do stuff, I'm going to come back to you, but you just sit there in the corner idle. But that way I can grab you and bring some power into my life to help me with, because I'm going through this now and I'm going through this and I'm going through this and Jesus, I'm going through this. And then, okay, Jesus, it's done. Fine. Okay, done with you. Go back in the corner. Who's God, right, in that situation? I am. I'm saying I'm God. Jesus, you can be God sometimes. Just like on an as-needed basis, you can be God. Right? That doesn't work in any relationship. Jesus isn't a tool. Jesus is the king. That's what Jesus' resurrection proves. So I got to change something. You don't crowd surf your way into God's presence, and you don't get into God's presence by treating him like a tool. And then the third obstacle keeping this guy from being with Jesus and experiencing his paradise is that he's just completely unrepentant. It never even occurs to this man that he might need to change, that perhaps the reason he is where he is because he has done what he has done, because he was what he was. He doesn't care that he had done evil. He doesn't care that he had done enough horrible things to deserve to be crucified on a cross. He isn't fazed by the sin inside of him. He just wants Jesus so Jesus can make his life a little better, get him out of the bind he's in, not change him. It's like going up to the doctor and going into the office and saying, Doc, I don't feel good. Would you make me feel better? And the doc's like, okay, let's run some tests. And he's like, okay, you're 50 pounds overweight. You got high blood pressure. You got high cholesterol, high blood sugar. You got liver disease. And there's a giant lump growing out of your neck. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to change your diet. We're going to start putting some exercise in. You're going to give up alcohol. You're going to change your lifestyle. And we're going to cut that thing off your neck and treat it and see what we got to do. And you're like, doc, you're just making me feel worse now. I want it to feel better. You say all these things, they make me feel bad. At some point, you've got to confront the sin inside of you, the guilt inside of you, and what's wrong with you. That's why you are the way you are. That's why you are where you are. That's why you're in the condition you're in. And listen, no place will be paradise until you deal with the sin inside of you. You deal with what's going on inside your heart. No place is going to be paradise. Because you'll go there, and that stuff will still be in you. Because at its core, sin is not about, oh, I broke some rule. Right? Sin is not, oh, I violated some law. Sin is about violating a person. It's about violating God. I heard Ravi Zacharias, some of you will know who he is. He's a famous speaker. I heard him tell this story, and I hesitate to tell it today because it's a really painful type of image, but I think we need to because I don't want anyone to walk out of here not clear about what's at stake. And he tells a story about trying to help this husband and wife go through a really difficult time because one evening the husband went out, and while he was out, a man broke into their home and at gunpoint raped his wife while the kids were in the other room. And for months, they tried to wrestle with that. And I don't know how you even begin to deal with something like that. The anger, the bitterness, the fear, the guilt, the shame, all that. And they sat there talking for hours. And at one point, Robbie just said to the woman, okay, you know, all this is inside of you. If you were to just in one outburst, just say what, just try and put words to what's going on in you and what you feel. Just in one outburst, what would you say? And she just screamed, I was violated. I hesitate to put you there, but I want to put you there. I want you to just, if you can just let your mind go there for a moment and empathize with that woman, you might be able to begin to sense how God feels about sin. It's not, oops, you broke a law. Oops, you didn't do something right the way I wanted you to do it. No, it's a violation of who he is. And there's Jesus on that cross, opening his arms wide and embracing our violation of him to the nth degree because of how much he loves us. Embracing our hatred, embracing all these things, not just so that you and I, oh, can get to go to heaven one day. No, but so that he can deal with this sin that's in this disease inside of you and inside of me and root it out, dig it out, remove it, burn it up, and replace it with his presence and paradise. So you and I can be transformed, not just go float on clouds and play harps. That's not the picture of paradise that God paints for us in his word. It is this engaging in God's presence and being with him and partnering with him in this creative activity of bringing order and beauty. That's what paradise is, not just sitting around all day with our feet up, but engaging. Come on, you've been on vacations where you get to a point where you're like, I got to do something, right? Because we're not made to just sit around. We want to engage. That's what God calls us to, this paradise where we're with him and we're engaged with him and we're able to create and make beauty. There is no place that'll be paradise, though, until you deal with the sin that's inside of your heart. But once you deal with that sin, once you ask Jesus to deal with that sin, then you can experience paradise anywhere. That's what's amazing. So don't be like that criminal. Let's be like the other criminal, the right way. Let's look at what he says to Jesus. He hears what that first criminal says, and he looks at him, and he rebukes him and says, don't you fear God? We're both under the same punishment here. We are punished justly, and we're getting what our deeds deserve, but he is completely innocent. He's done nothing wrong. And then he looks at Jesus and says, Jesus, will you please just remember me when you come into your kingdom? So here's how to respond to Jesus. One, don't get sucked into the crowd, but instead recognize who Jesus is. He's not swayed by anybody else. And in fact, this is the only time, this is the moment in the Gospels, the only time when someone truly recognizes Jesus for who he is. The disciples kept failing to recognize it. Obviously, everyone else was looking at Jesus and the mob and the Romans and the religious leaders, and they think he's powerless. There's no way he could be the Messiah. They're looking him in the eye, and they can't recognize that. Everyone else sees him as a weak, bloody mess who's powerless to save himself, much less anybody else. But this criminal sees something no one else has been able to really see. He sees that Jesus is pure and that this is not the moment of Jesus' failure, but the moment of Jesus' victory. And so he says this thing. He says, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And, you know, if you were to just hear that phrase and picture that being said, picture it like in a movie setting, for me, I picture it like, you know, Jesus on the edge of a battlefield. And he's got all his army with him. They're about to go into war. And one of his soldiers just comes up and says, remember me when you come into your kingdom today. Like, we're going to go win this battle, right? Not like he's there hanging on a cross, bloody and 90% dead. Because that's what this guy recognizes, because he's not paying attention to what anyone else says. He's looking at Jesus and seeing who he is for real. And so he says, remember me today. Today we kind of end up in the same place. We look around at all the tragedy and the pain. We look at how people suffer, and everyone assumes that this means God either doesn't love us enough to do anything about it, or he's not powerful enough to do anything about it. And there hangs Jesus on the cross saying, look what I have done about it. And all of these tragedies and atrocities around us, they're not proof Jesus is powerless or that he doesn't love us enough to do something about it. They're just proof and evidence of how horrible sin is and how horrible life is separated from God's presence. And the cross and the empty tomb demonstrate just how powerful God is because Jesus rose from the dead. And they demonstrate how much God loved us because Jesus died for you and for me. So don't get sucked into the whirlpool of people running away from God because they don't like what the world has become since we rejected God. That makes no sense. If you don't like life without God, then run to him, not away from him. This guy doesn't get sucked into the crowd. He recognizes who Jesus is, and then he recognizes that he is broken. That he is broken. There's a guy named Brian Stevenson who's an attorney. He wrote a book called Just Mercy. He's the founder of the Equal Justice Initiative. And he tells the story of a guy named Jimmy Dill, a convict who was killed, received the death sentence and was killed. And Stevenson took up Dill's case when there was just 30 days left, 30 days before the day they were going to execute this guy, because Stevenson found out, one, he was mentally incapacitated, and two, he couldn't afford legal representation. And the charges against him and the case against him had been so weak, but there was no one to speak for him. And they believed that the verdict should be overturned. But in those 30 days, they tried and tried to get him off death row. But in the end, there was nothing they can do. And he reflects on the moment that Dill called him just to say, thank you for trying. Thank you for trying. And he writes in this chapter called Broken, he writes about how broken we all are, how he realized how broken we all are. And this is what he writes. He says, when I hung up the phone that night, I had a wet face and a broken heart. I thought myself a fool for having tried to fix situations that were fatally broken. I worked in a broken system of justice. My clients were broken by mental illness and poverty and racism. They were torn apart by disease, drugs and alcohol, pride, fear, and anger. In their broken state, they were judged and condemned by people whose commitment to fairness had been broken by cynicism, hopelessness, and prejudice. And after working for more than 25 years, I understood that I do what I do because I'm broken too. My years of struggling against injustice had finally revealed something to me about myself. Being close to suffering and death and executions and cruel punishments didn't just illuminate the brokenness of everyone else. It also exposed my own brokenness. We all share the condition of brokenness. I desperately wanted mercy for Jimmy Dill and would have done anything to create justice for him. But I couldn't pretend his struggle was disconnected from my own. The ways in which I have been hurt and have hurt others are different from the ways Jimmy Dill suffered and caused suffering. But our shared brokenness connected us. We're all broken. And look, it's hard to convince people they're broken. So I'm not going to try to convince you. Some of you know and you see and you recognize the ways you're broken. Others of you, maybe you don't. What I'm going to invite you to do today is to put yourself in the place of that other criminal who, hanging there on the cross, looked at Jesus. And didn't, when he could have said things to justify himself and why he didn't deserve to be crucified and killed and murdered this way, He looked at Jesus and he couldn't say a word because he recognized Jesus was truly innocent. Jesus was truly pure. Jesus had done nothing wrong. And in the face of that, he fell silent and recognized how broken he was. I invite you to do that today too. Look at Jesus and see perfection. He did nothing and died for you and for me. You can justify yourself. You can keep sweeping that sin and that brokenness under the rug inside your heart and hiding it. Or you can sweep it out into the open and let Jesus deal with it. As long as it's in you, there'll be no paradise. But once you let it get out, if you give it to Jesus, then you can begin to experience paradise, God's presence anywhere. When you think about it, these two criminals are both, in the end, asking Jesus for the same thing. They're both asking Jesus, please save us. Save me. There's just a giant difference between saying, save me, Jesus, and saying, save me, Jesus. When that other criminal says, Jesus, please remember me, open about his brokenness, recognizing who Jesus is, Jesus looks him in the eye and he makes this promise, verse 43, truly I tell you, today you'll be with me in paradise. This may be the darkest moment of your life, but it is not too late. Today you'll be with me in paradise. You were created. I was created to be with God, to be with Jesus. This longing for paradise inside of you, whatever you were picturing when we started today, that longing is a longing for home. We're not home. And no matter how far you've wandered or how dark this moment might be in your life, Jesus wants nothing more than to look you in the eye and say, welcome home. That's the worship team that come up. There's a race every year called the Trans-Pac Race. It's the Trans-Pacific Race. It goes from Los Angeles to Hawaii via sailboat. And hundreds of boats do this race. And this guy named Bob Goff had a dream to go and do this race since he was a kid. He wanted to sail from Los Angeles to Hawaii and experience that. And so he, one year, got a bunch of his buddies, and they decided, hey, we're going to go for it. And so they got together. They entered this race. They didn't have a lot of skill sailing. They didn't know everything they needed to know, but they rented this. They got this 35-foot sailboat, and they packed all the Spam and all the chili and all the water they could onto this boat, and they set sail for Hawaii. And he said it was a crazy adventure, but scary too, because there were times they got lost. They ended up zigzagging all over the place because he wasn't a very good navigator. At one point, he didn't even know which way was north, and it took them way longer than it should have. It took them more than 2 weeks to do this trip, and it was scary because they were coming to the end of their food. And he talks about how, as they entered the marina, there's a tradition that no matter what time it is when you arrive, because ships all arrive, the boats all arrive at different times, no matter what time you arrive in that marina on Oahu, there's a guy who announces your arrival and just calls it out over this big speaker in the marina. And he said, it doesn't matter if it's the middle of the night or the middle of the day. He calls out and announces your arrival and welcomes you back, welcomes you home. And he said, just as we were running out of supplies, we found it, we got there, we arrived, and it was the middle of the night. We came around the bend, and it was still twilight, it was still like not quite morning, and we kind of just limped into that marina, and suddenly this voice crackled on the speaker and called out the name of their tiny little boat, welcoming them in, and then he started to name every one of the crew members. So-and-so, and these guys they were nobodies. They didn't even really know how to sail very well. And so-and-so, and he announced them like they were the president coming in. And then this guy, Bob Goff, talks about how when it came time to announce his name, he said he didn't say, oh, and here's the genius who got them lost. And here's the guy who zigzagged them all over the place from L.A. to Oahu. And here's the guy who didn't even know where north was. No, he just said, Bob Goff. And then after he'd gotten through all their names, and as they were slipping into port, that voice that for decades had been welcoming in these people on their boats, he just said to them in a just deep and sincere way, friends, it's been a long trip. Welcome home. said, because of the way he said it, we all just started to well up with tears and just wipe our faces because we didn't want to look weak. But we all just had these tears filling our eyes because in that moment we began to reflect on the journey and how messy it had been, how poor we had done, the mistakes we had made, how sloppy our sailing was. And none of that mattered. We were home. None of that was being announced. It was just our names. We were home. And he said, I've always thought that the end of this life might be a similar experience. After we cross the finish line in our lives, I imagine it'll be like floating into the Hawaiian marina, the beautiful flowers and trees everywhere in that garden of Hawaii. When our names are announced one by one, at the end of our lives, after our many mistakes and mid-course corrections, Jesus will simply say, friends, it's been a long trip. Welcome home. In Revelation, the last book of the Bible, Jesus says, to the one who is victorious, I will give the right to eat from the tree of life. I'll give them eternal life, which is in the paradise of God. And what makes paradise paradise is being with God. And no place will be paradise until you deal with that sin in your heart. But today, if you deal with that sin in your heart, and you give it to Jesus, then you can experience God's presence, paradise, anywhere. And know that this is now a journey, not into some dark ocean where you'll be lost forever, but it's a journey home. It doesn't matter what course your life has looked like, how you've zigzagged and gotten lost, you're here right now, right? Face to face with Jesus. Just like those two criminals on the cross on either side of them. Here we are, face to face with Jesus, and the decision is here for us. How will you respond to Jesus? And that's going to determine the eternity of your life. Because right now, today, you can begin to experience this paradise of knowing Jesus. You just ask him, forgive my sins, save me, lead me. Will you stop following all the crowds? Stop following what everyone else says and actually pursue Jesus. Will you stop ignoring your brokenness and begin to deal with it? But recognize who Jesus is and bring it to him. And ask him, please, Jesus, save me. Because what Jesus did on that cross is the only thing powerful enough to wipe away this sin, to wipe away our brokenness, to wash it away and bring us into the paradise of God, into life and purpose and a future. You stand and let's sing this song together.